Politics Uncensored with Ali Malani.
Hello, and you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald. Ali is still away and sick this week, so we're going to continue to wish him a speedy recovery. Come on, Ali, we need you better for the general election. Coming up on today's show, we've got a great lineup. We're going to be speaking to the former Conservative Defence Minister and candidate Tobias Elwood about his party's chances at the general election. We'll also be discussing the Green Party's campaign so far with their co-leader, Carla Denyer. As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme. But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
There have been lots of polls over the last year. There'll be hundreds more polls. The only one that matters is the one when the general election comes. And the choice of that election is clear. It's to stick with our plan that is working. It's delivering change for people, ensuring that they can have the peace of mind that there's a brighter future for their children, that we can have renewed pride in our country, or the alternative, which is Keir Starmer and going back to square one.
Now, you may have seen yesterday afternoon that a poll conducted on behalf of the Telegraph newspaper has predicted that Labour will win the biggest majority in more than a century with 516 seats, a so-called super majority. Now, the poll had the Conservatives knocked to their worst ever number of MPs in what would be beyond living memory at just 53. Rishi Sunak was predicted to lose his seat. Now, if that were to happen, it would be the first time a Prime Minister would have lost their seat at a general election. The Telegraph's poll had the Lib Dems as the third largest party at 50 seats. With 2 weeks to go until the election on July 4th, it's almost guaranteed that Labour will be the next party of government. And we're going to see various polls predicting the number of seats each party might get in the days to come. So, just how big is Labour's majority going to be? Well, joining me on this week's Politics Unwrapped is the journalist and broadcaster, Dahaba Ali Hussein. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Zoe, for having me.
Let's kick it off, OK? Is there a danger for Labour if people see polls like this one and just think, my vote doesn't matter, it's unnecessary, Labour are going to win anyway?
I think voter apathy is always a danger, isn't it, with any general election. I think particularly in a general election that was called so sharpishly as this one has been, and so much information and policies and so much information being targeted to the electorate, there is a danger that some people will think that their vote just doesn't matter, that all politicians are the same and they're not going to bother getting involved. However, I think what's really important to note here is that the British public, particularly the electorate, often view things through the prism of their own experience. For example, when we saw all of the Partygate scandals happening with Boris Johnson and etc., when those stories began to break, it didn't actually end up sinking Boris Johnson, at least not right away. That's because there was a lessening of COVID pandemic measures. People were allowed to go to the pub more. They were able to see their friends. And so they were starting to feel a little bit happier, meaning that they weren't feeling so disillusioned with the government. At the moment, what we're seeing is that members of the British electorate, the British public, up and down the country, are being crushed under the weight of the cost of living crisis, the mortgage crises, rising energy bills. I mean, we saw today that this week we saw that inflation has reached Bank of England levels of 2%, but interest rates are not going to be cut. That means hundreds of thousands of people every single month are coming to the end of their fixed term mortgage rates and are basically at their wit's end what they're going to do because they can't keep up with their payments. So in short, no, I don't think people are going to, I think people will still flock to the voting polls on July 4th.
So there's plenty of reasons for people to be angry and to want to vote the Conservative government out. That's really interesting. I mean, when I've been talking to voters, what I've got a lot of a sense of is people saying, actually, I don't like Labour and I don't like the Conservatives, so there's no point in me voting. I don't know who to vote for. Do you think there is going to be a problem of people just thinking, you know, under first past the post, when it's either going to be Labour or Conservatives, more and more that their vote just doesn't matter because it's one of the two incumbents and there's, you know, it's just going to always be Labour and Conservatives? I mean, how do you think we break through that and get people to vote regardless?
I think that's really interesting, actually, that you should say that, particularly because I was reading a report by the Resolution Foundation that came out a few months ago that said that actually there is a lot of voter apathy amongst people who are millennials, who are from a lower socioeconomic background. So non-home owning and non-graduate millennials are the least likely to turn up at the polling stations on voting day. And that's because they honestly believe that many politicians don't actually represent them. They think they're all the same, so there's no point. I think, to be perfectly honest with you, it's going to be about making policies accessible and making politics more accessible to your average person. So I think it's, don't get me wrong, love the way political news is done in this country. Absolutely chef's kiss to someone like myself who lives in an echo chamber and lives and breathes political news. However, Sharon from Doncaster wants to understand exactly how whatever minister stands up in whatever select committee, what they're saying, how is that going to translate to her immediate life?
Absolutely. Sometimes I think all this navel gazing we do around manifestos and, you know, really specific 100%. Policies, so much of politics is vibe based. You know, people 100%. Are like, do I think I'm going to be better off under this government or not? And sometimes that can just be whether they like the look of the leader or not.
Exactly. And we saw this in the 2019 election. The 2019 election was fought between Boris Johnson's get Brexit done or do we like the look of Jeremy Corbyn? That was essentially what an entire election campaign boiled down to.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Let's talk a little bit about these numbers. So we've seen absolutely huge majorities for Labour. Is there a... How good is it to have a really strong majority? I mean, is it good for democracy? Is it good for the party if it's just, you know, Labour, Labour, Labour and a handful of opposition?
I mean, in very simple terms, if Labour essentially... I've been reading a lot of analysis, as you do in your spare time, and essentially a supermajority doesn't technically exist in the UK constitution,
does it not?
So whatever party has a majority technically does by virtue have a supermajority and they can do whatever they like. I think if you have a massive majority in government, in some ways it is democratic because you received quite a few votes. In other ways, less so, because then you have parties who are on the fringes of the political sphere, like the Green Party, for example, not being well represented in Parliament. But then also you do get some people who have slightly controversial views, like Reform Party, also not being represented. So I guess this turns into a much broader question of, does the first past the post system still fit our constitution?
Absolutely. It's really interesting. Final question on this particular topic. People are discussing, there are rumours and whispers that Ed Davey, the leader of the Lib Dems, could be the leader of the opposition. Do you think that kind of Tory wipeout could happen, where actually they're not even the second biggest party in Parliament?
I mean, there was the historian, wasn't it, Corelli Barnett, who actually gave me one of my favourite quotes when I was studying my undergraduate degree, which was that political parties, obviously we all know there's a pendulum effect and it happens every few years in Parliament. And although, to be honest, I haven't seen it happen to this extent in modern British history. But they'll be wandering the political wilderness for many elections to come. I think if that were to happen and the Liberal Democrats were to become the leader, they were to become the leader of the opposition, then we would definitely see the Liberal Democrats' recent history being revised. I mean, I saw some very interesting statistics from the student loans company the other day saying that apparently your average student will now graduate with tuition fees lows of up to £50,000. So, I mean, and obviously the Liberal Democrats were famously part of the coalition government that raised tuition fees. So we could have an entirely new political playing field, which is super exciting to the likes of myself. And we'll have to see how that translates into your working average person's life.
Really interesting. While the rest of Europe seems to be moving towards the right, there's talk that we could not only have a left of centre government, but a left of centre opposition as well. Really, really interesting. OK, well, if that polling isn't a worry for the Tories ahead of the election, then this certainly might be.
I think it's quite awful. The idea that you bet on something but you know the result, that is immoral, it is illegal, and I can't believe people at the top of the Conservative Party are doing this and have allowed this to happen. This is corruption, frankly, and it needs to have a heavy hand from the top. Well, we think there should be a Cabinet Office inquiry. I think the Gambling Commission will rightly look at this. And I hope they come down heavy on those people who look like, I haven't seen the details, but they look like they've acted illegally and immorally.
Well, that is Lib Dem leader Ed Davey there, soon to be, maybe, leader of the opposition, although I doubt that. Well, the Conservative Party's Director of Campaigning, Tony Lee, is being investigated over a bet relating to the timing of the general election. His wife, Laura Sanders, who has worked for the Conservative Party and who is a Conservative candidate at this election, is also being looked into by the Gambling Commission. Ms Saunders is the second Conservative candidate to be investigated after Craig Williams, who worked as an aide to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. He is alleged to have placed a £100 bet on the election taking place in July, just 3 days before Rishi Sunak officially made the announcement. Well, Labour and the Lib Dems are calling for Ms Saunders to be suspended. The BBC reported earlier that Mr Lee has taken a leave of absence and left the party's campaign. It is not known when the bet was placed or for how much money. A Tory spokesman said the party had been, and I quote, contacted by the Gambling Commission about a small number of individuals. In related news, one of Rishi Sunak's close protection officers was arrested over alleged bets about the timing of the election earlier this week. Dahabat, this just feels like the cherry on top of the last 14 years of Conservative government to me. I mean, it is a party that reeks of scandal. Just how damaging do you think this particular scandal could turn out to be for the Conservative Party during this election? Or, you know, is it just all noise at this point?
It's quite fascinating, isn't it? Because it appears to me that the Conservative Party during this election campaign have been more focused on firefighting than they have on actually campaigning, whereas the Labour Party have been consistently marching to their policy beats. I think a scandal like this could be, they could go out with a whimper rather than a roar, if you know what I mean. I do believe this will be very damaging for them, but at the same time, I think it will just lead to the eye roll that people do when they place their tick amongst Labour in the against Labour's box on voting day.
Because you spoke about this before, how Boris Johnson was absolutely beleaguered by scandal during his time as Prime Minister. There was Partygate, and then there was, of course, the affair around Chris Pincher, who was a government whip who was accused of sexual misconduct. And there's been plenty of other incidents. So we had, you know, the Chancellor, former Chancellor, who was accused of not properly filing his taxes. We've had plenty of other sexual misconduct cases in the Conservative Party. Do you think this kind of scandal in sleaze is specific to the Conservative Party, or are we being a bit unfair? Is this just politicians in general?
I think Keir Starmer, just before we came on air, said something really interesting, didn't he, when he stood on the doorsteps in York somewhere and called upon Laura Saunders not to resign. He said that this just reeks of self-entitlement. And I think that is 100% correct. I think the Conservative Party is a party of self-entitlement, where they feel as though, and I don't know what it might be, might it be their background, might it be what they preach to each other in CCHQ, it's they feel entitled that they can be above, they can act above the law and act in ways that your average person would be penalised for.
I think it's really interesting, and obviously we have to make the point that at the minute this is all being investigated and it's all alleged, but there does seem to be something, and this is something I say to people when they say, I don't know, I can't feel the difference between the Conservatives and Labour, they feel the same to me. I just say, there is a difference, because if you look at the last 14 years of scandal and sleaze, and I'm not saying Labour is perfect, and I'm sure there will be all sorts of issues if they form a government, but the amount of sleaze we've experienced over the last 14 years seems to really outpace you know, any other government and what government should be doing. And I think when you look at Keir Starmer's history, particularly as former director of public prosecutions, a former lawyer, at a time where people are so untrusting of politicians, surely it's good to have somebody as a prime minister who has a legal background and seems to actually care about the rule of law.
It does feel like Keir Starmer is showing real integrity in this election campaign, and throughout his time as leader of the opposition, I dare say more integrity than the Conservative Party in their last premiership at the very least. I also think that when people say they don't really see the difference between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, well, I dare say you ask them to look a little harder, because if you actually delve a little, if you open the car bonnet and look amongst all of the car parts that I couldn't tell you the names of because I'm not a motor person, you will see that the Labour Party's policies, particularly on housing, particularly on the NHS, are benefit the average voting, the average voter much more. I mean, you only have to look at the stamp duty, the arguments today about the Conservative Party and the threshold for stamp duty. I mean, stamp duty really only affects a small percentage of people who are buying bigger houses in more expensive areas. Labour's policies will benefit the average voter. At least these two leaders will, obviously. The wider parties are, we don't know yet.
And let's just sum it up. I mean, how bad is it? If it is true that all these, you know, officials or people close to Rishi Sunak have been putting a bet on the timing of the general election, what does that tell voters?
It tells voters that they don't care. They do not care about this general election. The general election, I mean, there's been rumours about that so many MPs have been looking for their next jobs after this, that they are career politicians. They were only in it for their CV. They didn't care about any time beyond their premiership. And I think that's the message that voters need to take home, that they... you want a party and you want leaders who care about you in power.
Mm. I think it's really interesting that Craig Williams was alleged to have placed a £100 bet, and I think he was only going to make £500 off that, which, I mean, it's not an amount to be sniffed at, but I mean, really, come on.
I mean,
at least he's not getting paid enough.
I mean, I feel like he didn't fancy his own chances of getting that 80k salary.
Clearly. Yeah. Well, maybe they're very worried about being unemployed. Who knows? Okay, well, now moving away from the election, does this offend you? Well, Rishi Sunak has backed English manager Gareth Southgate's calls for fans not to sing about German casualties in the Second World War during the Euros after concerns were raised about chants. Following England's win over Serbia on Sunday and in the days since, there were reports and videos circulating of fans singing the chant 10 German bombers, defying warnings from German police. The Prime Minister said supporters should instead sing more of the Beatles' Hey Jude in honour of England star Jude Bellingham. What do you think, Dabba? Do you consider that chant offensive? Should England fans be free to sing what they like at the Euros in Germany?
Do you know what, Zoe? I'm absolutely baffled. I'm going to have to say I agree with Rishi Sunak. I think it is. I never thought I'd say those words.
It happens to the best of us,
I know.
You know?
I actually don't think they should be allowed to sing it. I think it's offensive. I think anything that is offensive should be banned as a form of hate speech. And on top of everything, even if the fact that it's not offensive and it's not hate speech, it's embarrassing. You know, England fans, when they go to these matches abroad, are always given the title that they're representing the country. And they kind of are. So I feel like if it's offensive, then, and I mean, it's just a song, right? If you're celebrating, you can sing something else. I do think it's really interesting, however, because it plays into this whole wider notion of the culture wars, which, I won't lie to you, took me many years to understand, because I didn't understand the importance of arguing about such fickle things. But according to some people, it is quite important. And Nigel Farage said on LBC just last week, this week, that apparently it's because people are being told they can't sing it, they're wanting to sing it more, and it's actually leading to more people voting for reform.
Wow, that's really interesting. When people are told, please don't do something, it's offensive, it sort of strengthens their case to do it more. I mean, do you think this is a sort of symptom of the division we're seeing in politics at the minute? And people, you know, I often hear when I do certain right-wing media outlets, they often say, you know, why can't we say this? Why is everyone trying to stop us from saying these things we feel? And I always wonder who they're talking about. Do you think there's a sense that somehow people are being policed more than they used to, or being not able to express themselves freely, and that's what's kind of triggering people to sing and say offensive things?
100%. And you know, a lot of the time I actually don't, a lot of people are mostly worried about their economic status. They're worried about what they have. They're worried about the money in their pocket. They're worried about the roof over their head. They're not actually angry. They just want an outlet. And when politicians, such as Nigel Farage, like I just mentioned, capitalise off this anger and off this disillusionment and give them a very easy target and a very easy threat, like, for example, immigrants, like, for example, people are trying to take away your civil liberties, and then they grasp onto it, because obviously, as we all know, and like Benedict Anderson wrote in Imagining Nations, don't worry, I'm not going to recite the entire book to you, in order to unite a community, the easiest way to do that is to have a common enemy. And I think for too long we've had divisive opinions being perpetuated by leading politicians, by even leading media figures, to unite a certain sect of British politics for their own gain.
Do you think that football brings us all together? Or do you think there are aspects of sort of football culture that can be quite divisive? I mean, do you think it's a sort of net positive for bringing the country together, or do you think it's a net negative?
I'll be very honest with you. As a woman of colour, I do remember very starkly, I think it was, excuse my football knowledge here, but I think it was the last Euros, or it might have been the World Cup, when all the black football players were being harassed online with monkey emojis and stuff like that. And I think in many ways it does bring the country together, but only if we're winning. And I think football does bring people together, but obviously we even see it in domestic violence cases. Like Women's Aid Charity have all this data about how domestic violence increases when England are losing, and it's apparently better when England are winning. So in a way, I think football has a long way to go in order to catch up with perhaps how progressive the UK and multicultural the UK actually is today.
Thank you so much, Dahaba. I really appreciate that. You've been a fantastic guest and I've loved talking about the Week Unwrapped with you. So that was the Week Unwrapped. Coming up next, we're going to speak to Green Party co-leader Carla Denyer about her party's election prospects. That's next. It is 17:20.
FUBAR Radio presents
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what's so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it. Like, I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them like a few weeks later sober and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common, what was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip. Actually, we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one. Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling. So for me to
very
place
good.
A bet on there would be pretty,
you know,
pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke, and I said I would because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral
standing. We should also talk about cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio.
At Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald. It is 17:22. Joining me on the programme now to discuss the Green Party's prospects at this election is Carla Denyer, co-leader of the Green Party and the party's candidate for Bristol Central. Thanks so much for joining me, Carla. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Carla, let's start off. What's a successful election for your party come July 5th?
I think, unlike the other parties, we're being quite open about what we think can be achieved in this election. We are standing candidates all over the country. We've broken our record for that. We're standing 574 candidates, so everyone will have the opportunity to vote Green. Oh. But we are targeting our resources on campaigning in the four constituencies where we have a very good chance of getting elected. So we think we can get four MPs elected in this election. In my constituency of Bristol Central, aiming to hold Brighton Pavilion, where the brilliant Sian Berry is hoping to take over from Caroline Lucas. My co-leader, Adrian Ramsey, in the new constituency of Waveney Valley. And finally, Ellie Chowns, former Green MEP in North Herefordshire, where I've just come from this afternoon.
Fantastic. So tell me, what is behind this kind of big push of support for the Green Party? Is it to do with Labour losing support from the Progressives? Is it to do with your successes at raising your profile? What do you think is driving this new support for you?
Good question. And I think that perhaps the reason you're asking is that it isn't any one factor. It's all of these things combining. We've seen a huge increase in support for green policies and the Green Party over the last few years. In fact, in the last five local elections, we have increased our number of councillors nearly fivefold. I don't think there's any other party in the UK that's even had five successive elections of gains. They've all had at least one and in most cases, several years of terrible losses. So we're feeling very buoyed and very grateful to everybody who has put their trust in the Greens at the local level. And what that means is that almost everyone in England and Wales now lives in a council that has at least one Green councillor elected. And so they've seen how hard Greens are working locally. And so when I'm out on the doorstep, whether it's in North Herefordshire or Bristol or Brighton or Waveney Valley, I'm hearing the message that people are excited at the opportunity to get more Greens elected at the next level up.
I want to quiz you a little bit on your manifesto. There's some really big, bold promises in here, which I think have been really welcomed by a lot of voters on the left. But my question is this fully costed and is it really feasible and affordable? Or is that not the point? I mean, you're never going to form the government. Is it more about ambition and showing what the Green Party stands for than it is about kind of really putting numbers behind these policies?
Yes, it is fully costed. And in fact, the Green Party is the only party that's being honest about the level of investment that is needed to fix our public services. And we've seen professionals from those public services, like health experts, coming out and saying that, for example, the Nuffield Trust said that both Labour and Conservatives' plans for the NHS wouldn't even keep services at their current levels. Labour and Conservatives are both proposing, although they're not admitting to it, even further cuts to an NHS that's already on its knees. Whereas we're talking about a £50 billion investment in NHS and social care per year by the end of the next parliament, plus a one-off capital investment to fix our crumbling GPs and GP surgeries, hospitals and so on. And we're not shy about talking about where that would come from, which is to make our tax system fairer. So introducing a wealth tax on only those with more than £10 million in assets. So that's clearly those with the broader shoulders who can easily afford to pay a bit extra, plus changes to capital gains and national insurance, both of which are basically removing the deliberate loopholes that were put into those taxes that benefit the richest at the expense of the rest of us. Those three changes alone would raise £50 to £70 billion a year by the end of the next parliament, which can then go towards funding good quality public services and paying our public sector workers, and that benefits everybody.
That's great. On housing, you've talked about banning no-fault evictions and putting in rent controls. And I know that you have a lot of support from younger voters. So one thing I found slightly disappointing was that you haven't actually really made any substantial promises on building new homes. I know you've talked about building 150,000 social homes a year. But why is there not a kind of concrete promise like Labour has made? You know, they've talked about 1.5 million new homes over the next 5 years. Why have you not committed to a similar sort of target?
Well, you're right that housing has been a big priority for us. And I've been a housing campaigner for my whole political life. I've been an active member of the Acorn Community Union for a long while. And so this is a big issue for me. And you're right. Things like scrapping no-fault evictions, that clearly has to go, long overdue, giving the power to councils to bring in rent controls and to require private developers to build the right kind of homes, including a good amount of affordable in the right places. With the
what do you mean by in the right places? Because we've got a mass shortage of homes in this country, and some people would hear you say that and think you're talking about letting those kind of NIMBY influences stop houses from being built in particular areas where actually housing is really needed.
It's not about being a NIMBY. It's about making sure that the kind of housing that's built is what meets local need. So if you've got a huge out-of-town luxury, you know, executive homes housing estate with 4, 5, 6 bedrooms, a double garage, but nobody in the village next door can actually afford to live there, and there's also no school places, no bus services, no local shops that actually make it a home. Instead, it's just an asset for the super rich to invest in. That doesn't actually help with the housing crisis. To come back to your original question about building homes, we absolutely need to build more homes. And our policy on creating more social homes is very ambitious. I think 150,000 new council homes a year by the end of the next parliament. That's more than any, or equal or more than any other party is offering. The reason that we're focusing on that in this manifesto is that government only has a certain amount of influence over what the private housing developers build. They can provide incentives and support and so on, but really the stuff that the councils, local councils and national government can influence directly is social homes, affordable homes, and so that's our priority. We're saying that's going to be our focus, but that for the ones that are developed by the private sector, we will give councils the power to shape them a little bit more than they can at the moment to make sure that it is meeting local need. Mm.
Thank you very much. That was Carla Denyer, co-leader of the Green Party and the party's candidate for Bristol Central. Lots of interesting stuff in the Greens manifesto. Okay, the time is 5:30. After the break, we're going to be hearing from Tobias Elwood, former Tory Defence Minister and Tory candidate.
FUBAR Radio presents What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Joining me now is Dr. Natalia Spearings, consultant and dermatologist. Round of applause for you. So, next one.
Yeah.
Water. Is it the best medicine that we can possibly give to our skin?
If you drink it?
Yeah.
Okay.
just bathing it. No, if you drink loads of it.
If you drink it. So, no, not really, because your body's really good at maintaining its water balance. So, there is no evidence to suggest that drinking excess water makes your skin more hydrated. Sorry. Though it's good for general health. So, don't stop drinking water just because I said that.
You know what? There's so many different opinions on water. We had someone a few weeks ago that drank too much water and she almost drowned herself. And now we're saying that it doesn't help with the skin. I'm like, what? Does that even have any benefit?
Every Tuesday.
FUBAR Radio.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald. We just heard from Carla Denyer, co-leader of the Green Party, on where her party's stand is going into the next election. Well, how about the Conservatives, who remain 20 points behind Labour in the polls and who, according to some polls, are on track for a monumental wipeout? Well, let's bring in Tobias Elwood, former Defence Minister and the Conservative candidate for Bournemouth East. Tobias, thank you so much for coming on the programme. Tell me, what do you make of your party's election campaign so far?
No doubt about it. This is one of the toughest election campaigns that I've ever participated in for a whole host of reasons. And I can just appeal, as I think many parliamentarians or candidates will, is that if the polls are correct and we're heading to some form of Labour supermajority, then we have to ask ourselves, is this good for Britain? And so I would appeal to the electorate, you know, to look at who they're sending back to Parliament. The curiosity of our structure, our system, is that the gene pool of people that make up government come from Parliament. So this isn't just a race of numbers to number 10, who's going to get the keys to number 10. It's all about also who's going to be making up the legislative as well. So if it does look like the polls are correct and we're going to get a supermajority, that is not good for Britain. And I simply ask that people recognise that we need competent, experienced people to go back up there, to be able to hold whoever is in power to account. What we don't want is any party of any hue dominating Parliament in the way that perhaps has been indicated by the Telegraph front page today.
What's behind your party's fall in the polls? Is it to do with Rishi Sunak being a bad leader, or is it to do with your policy failures? What do you put this decline down to?
Well, firstly, I think always if any party, Conservative or Labour, goes for the centre ground, then you increase your chance of winning the election. That's the British way of life. There's a sweet spot, if you like, in the centre ground. And if you own that, for us, it would be from the centre right. And you go back in our history from Disraeli, Baldwin, Churchill, Thatcher, David Cameron, you win. You get across the line. Tony Blair illustrated this as well. But if you go to your extremes, then you're only going to satisfy your base or a little bit beyond that. And we've given up that center ground a little bit. Rishi Sunak has done well to pivot us back, taken us into far calmer political waters after the difficulties of the end of Boris Johnson and Liz Truss.
Has he taken you back into calmer political waters? I mean, you're on track, according to some of the polls, to the largest wipeout in years and, you know, may never return from it. I mean, how has he taken you back into calmer political waters?
Well, we've just seen inflation go down to 2%. Confidence in business is returning.
But is that down to Rishi Sunak?
You've got to let me finish the question. You keep asking me a question and then throwing another question in.
Oh, I'm just curious to know, is inflation down to Rishi Sunak?
I'd like to hear your response. But we have moved into calmer political waters. There was an awful lot of turmoil, and we breached a lot of trust with the British people with Liz Truss, and things did calm down. But I'll put my hand up to say that the tribal warfare that continued, despite that, despite us in a fiscal responsibility turning, returning to the Conservative Party, has been difficult as well. And then I'd add to that too, the other dimension here. So the economy is always important to the electorate. The security is also important too, because people recognize that security in the economy, because of what happened in Ukraine and indeed the Middle East, is important too. But unity, you want to see a winning team. You want to be able to see a team that is actually enthusiastic, that's determined to stay in power. And I'm afraid over the last recent past, we haven't demonstrated that, reached that trust with the British people. And despite Rishi Sunak's best efforts, it's been very, very difficult indeed.
So let's talk a bit about security and defence, because I know that's, you know, a topic of great interest to you. And it's something that Rishi Sunak was trying to, it seemed like he was trying to bolster a lot of the campaign around. So he's vowed to boost UK defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030. Is that enough for you, do you think, to kind of combat some of the issues we're facing on the global scale?
I think that's an important question. I don't think it is enough. I mean, the question that sits above that is, why do you have to do this? Look what Putin is doing. He's just gone to North Korea with a shopping list of goodies to bring back so he can continue pursuing his war in Ukraine. He's then gone to Vietnam, which we thought had advanced and moved on to a greater friendship with the West, but rekindle that alliance there. They're still using Warsaw Pact equipment too. And of course, what sits behind Russia increasingly is China. And there is an alliance developing with Iran too. And half of the turmoil in the Middle East is actually caused by Iran. We've moved into an era of instability. And that's why Britain has to bolster its own resilience, its own defense posture, moving to 2.5%, which I think there's a NATO summit coming up in Washington, D.C. shortly, will become the new norm. But as you implied, I think we're going to have to go further than that, simply because the peace, the relative peace that we've enjoyed since the end of the Cold War, that is now over. Globalization, as we knew in its previous form, is dead, as Russia, China, and Iran lure ever more states, countries, and chunks of the world to agree with their outlook, their versions, their interpretation of our international rules-based order, which is challenging ours. We're going to see our world, I'm afraid, potentially splinter into two spheres of competing influence. It's going to be a dangerous, rocky, bumpy decade.
Your party posted a graphic on social media yesterday, I believe it was, of Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un and the Chinese president as well, all sort of rubbing their hands behind Keir Starmer's back, sort of to suggest that they would be happy and they would be emboldened by Keir Starmer becoming prime minister. Do you think that's a fair thing to put on social media? Do you think that's a fair analysis of the geopolitical situation if Keir Starmer were to become prime minister?
Well, it's certainly the last couple of elections that I fought, you had Jeremy Corbyn in power. He did want to potentially take us out of NATO, reduce our nuclear deterrent, and indeed reduce the size of the armed forces. I think it's still pursuant of Keir Starmer, given that is so recent, to be able to prove that actually defence of the realm, of Britain playing a role on the international stage, is something that Britain absolutely needs to do. Otherwise, yes, these other countries will greet with pleasure the fact that there could be a socialist model of governance coming into the UK.
But Keir Starmer has matched you on the 2.5% spending. He's matched your party.
I'll stand corrected, but I'm not sure that they have pledged that yet. I know that there's talk that they would like to head that way, but I'm not sure that's a manifesto commitment, but I am happy to be corrected. That's good to hear. I would like to see, normally as in the case, in the States is the same, that when it comes to foreign policy and indeed defence, there's not a lot of difference between the two main political parties. And that should be a good thing. As I stress, it was Jeremy Corbyn that threw that out completely, given where he wanted to take Britain's entire defence architecture.
So my point on that is Starmer has, you know, I think they've said they want to scale up to 2.5%. That is the number they're looking at. That, you know, he's remained committed to NATO, other international obligations. And actually, he seems, you know, he's actually more committed to things like membership of the ECHR than some faction of the Tory party. I mean, do you think on the basis of that, that particular graphic put out by CCHQ is reasonable and fair?
I confess I've not seen that graphic, so I'm not able to comment on the ECHR. It would be clear madness. This is something that Churchill helped craft. It's such an important treaty, but it needs updating. There's no doubt about it. And I think whoever wins the next general election will be looking to update it. It was written just at the aftermath of the Second World War. It's not really, it does need aspects of it reviewed. Let's do that. That's the way Britain should do it. We should look at treaties, international institutions, and update them, upgrade them, rather than run away from them. Certainly, if we did leave it, we'd lose friendship with the United States, because it's actually core, it's pivotal to the Good Friday Agreement. And that, of course, the United States wants to make sure is sacrosanct.
Tobias Elwood, thank you so much. That was Tobias Elwood, former Defence Minister and the Conservative candidate for Bournemouth East. Coming up, from small boats crossings in the Channel to the government's failing Rwanda scheme, we're going to speak to migration policy campaigner Zoe Gardner about how the immigration issue might affect your vote at the ballot box. It is 5:40.
FUBAR Radio presents
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what is so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it, like I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them a few weeks later sober and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common, what was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip. Actually, we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one. Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling. So for me to place a bet on there would be pretty, you know, pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke, and I said I would because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral
standing. We should also talk about cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio.
At Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Let's talk about migration. How will the different parties' immigration pledges affect your vote? And we'll also be discussing the frankly shocking news reported by the BBC earlier this week, claiming that the Greek Coast Guard has caused the deaths of dozens of migrants in the Mediterranean over a three-year period, including nine who were deliberately thrown into the water. Well, joining me now, we've got Zoe Gardner, an independent migration policy campaigner. Thank you so much for joining me, Zoe. We'll get onto that news from Greece. But before that, can you tell me, how big an issue is immigration at this election?
Hi there, and thanks for having me. Yeah, I mean, I think that immigration is becoming more and more of an issue at this election, driven by politicians who it serves for us to be talking about immigration, but not driven from the priorities of the people of the country. Because if you look at poll after poll after poll in the lead up to this election, everybody was saying that the state of the NHS and our public services and the cost of living in the economy were the things that were really important to them in this election. And immigration, depending on which group of voters you're asking, comes a distant third or even a fifth, sixth, seventh down the list after the environment, after housing, after all sorts of other considerations that really impact people's daily lives. So it wasn't really important to us going into this. But obviously, there's a media narrative. There's a huge amount of momentum behind Nigel Farage. And he's been driving this agenda to make this an immigration election instead of a cost of living election, instead of an NHS election. And actually, that's been gaining traction.
The thing that's really been winding me up about when people interview Nigel Farage is that they don't seem to be putting to him the fact that we didn't really have this small, in, you know, inverted commas, small boats crisis until we left the EU. Previously, as you know, we had a returns deal with Europe, if you know, and there wasn't this kind of market for people smugglers to send people over on small boats. Nobody seems to be putting to him that Brexit has in part caused this huge number in small boat crossings. Is that a fair analysis? Would you say that that is correct? And do you think that people should be challenging Nigel Farage on that? After all, he is the architect of Brexit.
Yeah, I think it's a very mixed and complicated picture, but definitely Nigel Farage needs to be challenged more for the implications of Brexit as a whole. None of the things he promised us have come to pass. And most of all, there was that key point during the Brexit campaign, I don't know if you remember, that Breaking Point poster where he stood in front of a picture of refugees, mainly from Syria, who were walking, you know, destitute through Europe. And he said, we're at breaking point, you know, we need to leave the EU because we need to get rid of these refugees who are seeking our protection. And obviously, that was never, ever going to be a credible way to approach that, because our obligations to refugees don't come from the EU. They come from international law. And leaving the EU didn't like set us loose off floating off into the Atlantic. We are still a destination and will always be a destination for some refugees. And then when it comes to like how Brexit specifically impacted the boats, it is a bit of a mixed picture, but certainly it will have impacted the choice of boats rather than lorries and trucks, because it no longer mattered that you were apprehended in the process of crossing into the UK from France, because that's when, if you could prove that somebody had crossed from another European country, another EU country into the UK, and could have sought asylum there previously, then we previously could undertake a return to that other EU country. We can't do that anymore. So now people don't have to hide on the journey coming over. And that's why it's so much more visible now on the boats. It's also increased numbers because now that we're not part of that process of passing the parcel of refugees around Europe, anybody who has been denied protection and not been able to find protection in the EU still feels that they have a chance of finding protection in the UK. So we're becoming more and more of a last resort for people who wouldn't originally have chosen the UK as a destination, but haven't found the protection they need in the EU.
That's really interesting. Interesting. We hear a lot in the media about the sort of negatives of migration. And, you know, I was out speaking to voters just the other week, and a lot of people were sort of talking about, you know, this country's full and I can't get a doctor's appointment and I can't get housing and it's all because of immigration. Can you maybe dispel that myth a little bit and maybe talk a little bit about some of the net positives of immigration?
Yeah, and I think it's really important too, because as I say, the more these myths get repeated, the more people pick them up and think that this is actually the cause of their problems. The truth is that immigration brings huge positives to our communities. The reason why we have a housing crisis, and any homelessness charity, anybody who is an expert on homelessness and advocating for the homes we need to be built in this country will tell you the same thing. It's not because of immigration, it's because of a multitude of factors, mainly that we've been selling off social housing and not building it fast enough to replace that. So in the last 10 years, we've had a net loss of social housing of about 260,000 houses. At the same time, we have elements of our demographic makeup in the UK. So people are living for longer. That's great, but it means they need homes for longer. More families are now split up. That's less great, maybe, but it does mean that there means there needs to be more households for families than there previously used to be. So there's lots of reasons why we don't have the houses we need. And first and foremost among them is the failure of politicians to meet even their own insufficient pledges to build affordable housing. So that one is absolutely untrue. And it's it would be like blaming young children who've just been born to British people for needing housing as well. Housing is just a human right. We all need it, and we need enough houses for the people in the country, not to reduce the number of people in the country to fit the outdated amount of housing we have. And then with public services, it's even more obvious, because most migrants who come here are relatively young, they are relatively healthy, they don't make the same amount of use of public services as the local population do, but so many of them work in our public services. And what would be an existential threat to our public services would be to cut immigration at the levels that the likes of Nigel Farage is talking about. That would destroy our NHS, it would destroy our social care system. And you know what? It would prevent us from being able to build houses too, because lots of the skills in construction are brought in by immigrants as well.
Thank you so much, Zoe. That was fascinating. And we should definitely get you on again, because I could talk to you for ages about this. Zoe, thank you. That was Zoe Gardner, an independent migration policy campaigner. The time is 5:50.
FUBAR Radio presents
The Dating Show.
Because I don't see a problem watching porn if you're in a relationship.
No, I don't either. No. I don't see
a problem. No, I don't see that as a massive deal. But if there is actually someone on the other end of that, is it then a bit dodgy?
Well, let's think. So say you're in bed with your beautiful partner and she gets out of bed at 2 a.m, leaves you in bed, you're laying there all cozy and happy. She goes into the bathroom and you hear her talking to another man and being sexually aroused over it. And I imagine masturbation. So if you'd walked in on her masturbating live with another guy, how would that make you feel?
Yeah, I'd be fucked off, actually, I think.
Every Friday, FUBAR Radio.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald. Okay, it is 5:51. Listen, we've heard about immigration, one of the issues that might sway you one way or another. But now let's move on to another issue, which I think is absolutely integral at this election: housing. With rents continually rising across the UK and the opportunity of getting on the property ladder less and less likely for many young people, housing policy will be under the spotlight at this election. Well, with me to discuss this is Conor O'Shea, who is the Policy and Public Affairs Manager at Generation Rent, a campaign group for private renters. Good to have you on the programme, Conor. Are any of the parties standing out on housing policy at this election?
Zoe, nice to speak to you again, and good evening, listeners. Hope you're tuning in at halftime in the England game to talk the big issue of the election, in our view, which is housing. From a renter's point of view, there's a lot to be encouraged by, to be honest. It's really vitally important that the parties take seriously the issues that renters face. And they all do. All the four major parties do have an offer for renters. We can quibble about the details of them, and there's certainly we'd like them to go further. But the fact that they do understand that renters in this country are suffering so badly and they have got an offer for them is a good thing. Across the board, all four of them have agreed that Section 21 no-fault evictions have to go, that they have to be outlawed. Forgive my cynicism, that was the case 5 years ago as well, and we still haven't seen them gone. But the fact that there's consensus on that issue is really important. So that's something that all renters should be able to look forward to in the next parliament.
I saw a tweet yesterday that just absolutely boiled my blood, which was somebody posting about a room for rent in London, £1,300 a month, no working from home allowed. Is this the state of the rental market in London? Is it really that terrible for young people?
The state is the very minimum thing you could say. It's an absolute jungle out there. It's completely ridiculous. I'm pleased that you highlighted that totally disgraceful
awful
offer. We did too. And Zoe, you're very good at pointing those things out when you do see it. But we're yeah, that is what renters are living day in, day out. Unfortunately, like you might talk to people who are a little bit removed from the rental sector, and they'd be shocked and stunned by just how awful it is. But renters understand this. Renters know that this is what people have to go through. It's really terrible. Two things that have come out of the Labour Party manifesto, or the Labour Party offer to renters today, that I think will be of interest to people, is that there will be a banning of bidding wars, and there'll be a banning of multiple months rent being asked up front. And they're two things that people are being asked about all the time in renting, that they're being asked, how high can you go? Can you add 50 quid a month? Can you add 100 quid a month? And that's how they're basically determining who gets to live in the home. Or saying you must pay 2, 3, 4, 6 months rent up front in order to secure a home. They're both completely ridiculous practices. They are not part of a civilized society in any way, shape or form, but it's the sort of thing that renters have got to face. So we're really happy that the Labour Party and others are taking this sort of issue seriously. But you're right, it just proves the absolute state of the market across the board.
So what's gone wrong here? Is it a matter of there just simply not being enough houses in this country, and therefore landlords can charge obscene rents and ask for obscene things? Or is it a bit more complex than that?
There is an element of that, and we've seen that from the major parties, that they all are committed to pretty large house building targets. We welcome that. It's really important that we do build more homes. We haven't got enough, full stop. But these homes have to be the right types of homes. We've got a specific shortage of council homes, council houses, that people so desperately need, that there are people who really shouldn't be in the private rented sector sort of at the behest of landlords at all. They should be looked after by the local authority, but there's just not enough homes for them. So that's something really important, that as this building takes place, that we're building the right things for the right people in the right places, social homes being a huge part of that. We also just need some more regulation in the private rented sector. It's a bit of a wild west. Landlords are at their sort of whim. They can do whatever they want. And we end up with some of these ludicrous practices that you're right to highlight. One of them just being the amount of rent that's being charged. It's completely immoral. It's completely wrong in society that our homes are being threatened and our livelihoods are being threatened by just extortionate rent rises. That's something that the next government cannot ignore, because it's having such a detrimental impact on society, but most importantly, it's having a terrible impact on the people that live in these homes.
Why do you think it's taken so long for this to become a political issue? Is it just that, you know, and I should say it doesn't just affect young people, there are obviously older people as well who are in completely unsuitable and costly rented accommodation. But is it because it's sort of mainly a young person's issue and it's just not something therefore that's on the political agenda for politicians?
Well, it's a funny one for me to be talking about, because I work for an organisation called Generation Rent, and that obviously invokes the notion of younger people who are trapped in renting. But it's a bit of a misnomer, really, because it is true for people of all ages and stages. We're seeing so many more families and young children growing up in rented accommodation than we've seen before. Lots and lots of people who are renting into their retirement and the problems that are associated with that. Basically, renting is quite a huge section of society at the moment. It's 12 million people. It's about 1 in 5 households. That's a lot. And actually what we have at the moment is a rented sector that's not designed to have that many people in it. The regulation hasn't caught up with the proportion of society that's renting their homes, because they can't afford to buy them, but also for various other reasons that you might want to be a renter. So if there's going to be 1 in 5 people in this country living in a rented home, there has to be proper protections for them so that they can't be turfed out onto the street with just 8 weeks' notice through no fault of their own, for example, as currently exists with Section 21. So we've really got to sort of look at the rented sector and go, it's home to so many, we've got to treat them right.
Mm. What is your one ask, final question, what is your one ask for, let's presume it's a Labour government, why not? Let's just believe everything we're reading. What do you want them to bring in that would help the rented sector?
The abolition of Section 21 is massive. There's no silver bullet, as we always say, but that's a massive deal, knowing that people can stay in their homes for longer. But ambitiously and properly, we need a serious conversation and some class of regulation on rental increases, because that's what's damaging people's health. They're being thrown out of their homes. They can't afford to stay. It's people putting rent above putting food on the table and all the sort of horror stories that you know, because the rents are just going through the roof. So we need to have a fair mechanism that means that rents cannot go up by what we recommend that Generation Rent as part of the Renters Reform Coalition is the lowest inflation and what local wage growth. It feels like a very logical metric where people can just know exactly how much their rent is going to go up each year, and it's based on reality. It's based on what people actually have, as opposed to the crazy numbers that we're seeing at the moment.
Thank you so much. That was Connor O'Shea, Public Affairs Manager and Policy at Generation Rent, who campaigned for private renters. Well, that's it for Politics Uncensored this week. Thank you so much for listening to me. Join us next week again, when hopefully we'll have Ali back and we can continue to unwrap the week's political twists and turns as the UK heads ever closer towards that big July 4th general election date. Stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can also find me if you want to, at Zoe Grunewald. If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up on foobarradio.com. See you next Thursday from 5 p.m. for another episode of Politics Uncensored.